Well, this week, the weather turned rather cold, and one day, when going out to meet a friend, I reached into my closet and pulled out a red and black checkered fleece button-up shirt. And it wasn't until I put this on over a pair of jeans that I realized it looked a little, dare I say, hipsterish. And I was amused by that. And so in the spirit of the modern hipster record collector, let's listen to some vinyls. Of course, I had to just let it sit and stew for about 3 minutes. I know these aren't vinyls. We're listening to Shellac Records here on the appropriately named Shellac Stack program. My name is Brian Wright. Welcome to you all. And we're going to have fun today. I've got a good stack of records for you. We started out with Miff Mole and His Little Molars. And just listen to the lineup on that record. We have Red Nichols on trumpet, Miff Mole on trombone, Fud Livingston on the clarinet. He's also the guy who wrote that tune called Feelin' No Pain. Adrian Rollini, the bass saxophone player, Arthur Shutt at the piano, Dick McDonough on banjo, Eddie Lang on guitar, and Vic Burton at the drums, recorded in New York City, August 30th, 1927. As I say, the tune called Feelin' No Pain, and we'll leave aside the beverage-related connotations for the moment and focus on Feelin' No Pain in the sense that we're going to just settle back and enjoy some good records on today's program. We're going to start by heading over to London for a pair of recordings made in that city. The first, recorded in Small Queen's Hall by Jack Hilton and his orchestra. I don't think I've yet played a Jack Hilton record here on the Shellac Stack. I love his band. And so we're going to listen to You're the Cream in My Coffee. And this is the exact same arrangement that Max Raab and the Palast Orchestra go around performing even today. And I was fortunate enough to get to hear them do it in person when they stopped by Pittsburgh, oh, I guess about 6 or 7 years ago. But here we'll hear it in an original period recording from the His Master's Voice label, number B5650. Great De Silva Brown and Henderson tune. It's Sam Brown singing the vocal, though he's uncredited on the label. And this comes from May of 1929. We'll follow that with a little something silly from Ambrose and his orchestra, recorded a few years later in London in July, on July 4th, actually, 1935. Donald Stewart will sing South American Joe, issued here in the States on a Decca 78, number 611. But we start first in Small Queen's Hall with Jack Hilton and his orchestra.
Got hair without a kink in it, flashing eye, and what a wink in it, see. of American show. And when he twirls that dark mustachio, you will see a real Picasso. See, South American Joe. Sweet senoritas come out every night on their balcony. Mama's asleep in the patio. Shh, here comes Joe. He's good looking and magnifico. As a lover, terrifico. See, South American Joe. Look out for your wife. Look out for your girl. Look out for your watch. Look out for your rings whenever he sings. Must you go your way? Must I go Paraguay? Then we'll meet again. I love you so. Look out for your wife. Look out for your girl. Look out for that guy. Look out for his eye. He knows tricks of all variety, and he can mix in high society. See, South American Joe. And every home he puts a sandal in, he makes the lady play her mandolin. See, South American Joe. He's got a brother, Bolivia, me in Bolivia. Got another in Ecuador. Spanish for Isidore. There's a price upon his headio. Women want him, but not daddy-o. See, South American Joe. That's Joe. That's Joe.
Gosh, aren't those both good? I love both of those. First, Jack Hilton and his orchestra, an HMV record. You're the Cream in My Coffee. And after that, Ambrose and his orchestra, Decca 611, South American Joe. Both of those recorded in London. You're listening to The Shellac Stack, a program featuring a variety of 78 RPM records from the first half of the 20th century. And, you know, it is that time of year again, whether we like it or not. Hopefully we like it. And Gene Autry will help us get in the mood. This is not Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, or even When Santa Claus Gets Your Letter, or Frosty the Snowman, other big hits that Gene Autry had around Christmas time in 1949 and 1950. This comes from a couple years later, recorded in Hollywood, July 20th, 1952. And I think by this time, the well was starting to run dry for Gene Autry when it came to novelty Christmas tunes, because I don't believe I've ever encountered Merry Texas Christmas, you all, anywhere else except on this 78, which comes incidentally with a very nice picture sleeve, which I'll see if I can put up on the page for this program as well. We'll follow that with something a little more traditional, though perhaps done somewhat untraditionally, the Slam Stewart Quintet, a marvelous jazz record on the Continental label. We'll hear their treatment of Jingle Bells, featuring Slam Stewart's great talking bass. That was recorded in New York, May 28, 1945. But first, here's a Columbia record, Gene Autry with the Cass County Boys. Merry Texas Christmas, you all.
We have no jingle bells or sleigh to display on Christmas Day, for there's no snow down Texas way, but we sure mean it when we say Merry Texas Christmas, you all. Merry Texas Christmas, you all. May your days be sunny and bright, may your hearts be happy and light. Merry Texas Christmas, you all.
Merry Texas Christmas, you all. Merry Texas Christmas, you all.
May your days be sunny and bright. May your hearts be happy and light. Merry Texas Christmas, you all. Wishes only could come true, we'd wish that we could send to you a gushing oil well or two, and say hi there and wish you Merry Texas Christmas, you all. Merry Texas Christmas, you all. May your days be sunny and bright. May your hearts be happy and light. Merry Texas Christmas, you all.
Merry Texas Christmas, you all. Merry Texas Christmas, you all.
May your days be sunny and bright. May your hearts be happy and light. Merry Texas Christmas, you all. May your days be sunny and bright. May your hearts be happy and light. Merry Texas Christmas, you all. Merry Texas Christmas, you all. Merry Texas Christmas, you all.
That a neat record? The Slam Stewart Quintet, recorded in May of 1945, Jingle Bells, arranged by P.D. Vitch. And in case you were wondering, the Slam Stewart Quintet for that session included Slam Stewart, of course, on the bass, Red Norvo at the vibraharp, Johnny Guarnieri, no slouch there, on piano, and Celeste Bill de Arango on guitar and Maury Feld on drums. That was Continental Record number C-10003. Electric Process, it still says on the label, and Sepia Swing, the series for that. Before that, we heard Gene Autry and the Cass County Boys, a little something I pulled out in honor of a recent trip I took to Texas. I was there for a week last month, and visited some friends, gave a ragtime concert, solo piano concert in San Antonio, and made some recordings of a pianist friend William McNally for a future CD release on my Rivermont label. So for all my friends in Texas, we offer Merry Texas Christmas, you all. Gene Autry and the Cass County Boys, as I say, on Columbia 90172. That was recorded out in Hollywood, something I find amusing for some reason, July 20th, 1952. The tune by Leon A. Harris Jr. and Bob Miller. Well, I opened the last Shellac Stack program with a recording by William Jennings Bryan, made in 1908 as Bryan was out on the campaign trail running for president of the United States. We all know now he was ultimately unsuccessful. It was, I believe, his third bid for the presidency, and still not successful. His opponent, though, was William Howard Taft. And my friend Ethan Uslan in North Carolina, listening to the program, wrote to me and said, why don't I give equal airtime to Bryan's opponent, to William Howard Taft? So that's what we'll do, because Taft made records that year as well. In fact, the entire campaign was remarkably well documented on phonograph records from both sides. So we're going to listen to a Victor 78, number 5556, by William Howard Taft, and he's speaking on the subject of postal savings banks versus insurance of deposits. In a nutshell, the issue was that Taft was proposing that banks should not be forced to have any kind of guarantee of deposit or any kind of enforced insurance, that that would essentially be placing an undue burden on those unscrupulous, on rather the fair and honest bankers to benefit the unscrupulous ones. And so Taft was suggesting that instead we should augment the existing banking system to allow for postal savings banks, banks as part of the post office system, a system which had been tried and used successfully, he argued, in other countries and which made sense to use here. On the alternative side of the fence, Bryan contended that doing so would take money out of rural areas and put it into Wall Street banks, essentially, so the Democratic ticket was opposed to this idea. Ultimately, we know later on, I suppose, the FDIC was brought about, and we now have some degree of insurance in our banks. Going back to the issue of recording the campaign in 1908, both Taft and Bryan, as I said, made a number of records, both for the Edison Phonograph Company and for the Victor label. And the Edison recordings have been collected by the people over at Archaeophone Records some years ago. They made a wonderful CD compilation on the 100th anniversary of the 1908 campaign, and they call it simply Debate 08. And if you're interested at all in learning more about this or hearing more recordings of Bryan and Taft, I highly, highly recommend it. It comes with a massive booklet, well illustrated and very well annotated, that helps to put each of these recordings into context. And it seems that what demonstrators would do back in 1908 is they would set up two phonographs and have records from the competing candidates, and they would sort of play them back and forth for passersby as a way to sort of mimic in-person debate. Remember, the phonograph was still something of a novelty in 1908, and being able to hear the candidates was a new thing for most people. I don't know that any subsequent campaigns were as well documented on record as was the campaign of 1908. And this recording, a little bit of background on this one by Taft, it was recorded in Hot Springs, Virginia on August 5th, 1908. Hot Springs, the home of the Homestead Resort, where Taft was staying for a few days after he had come out of the, the convention in Cincinnati, where he had given this speech that we're about to hear. Yes, he had given it there on July 28th, 1908. So this is just about a week later. Taft was taking some time off at this Homestead Resort in Virginia, and the Victor Company sent a portable recording unit there to record some of his speeches, but they had to work around Taft's schedule, and that meant that this recording was not made until sometime in the middle of the night, according to the recording engineer who recalled all of this later. He said he had to be ready on a moment's notice to hustle in with the equipment, set it up, and make the recording. And that call came in at, I think, about 1 or 2 a.m. that Taft was finally ready to make these recordings. You'll hear Taft stumble over a few words. Clearly, the speech was still somewhat new to him, and perhaps the lateness of the hour and his own tiredness contributed to it as well. Nevertheless, it's interesting to hear William Howard Taft in person, and without further ado, that's what we'll do. Here he is, William Howard Taft, August 5th, 1908.
The Republican platform recommends the adoption of a postal savings bank system. The government guarantee will bring out of hoarding places much money which may be turned into wealth-producing capital and will be a great incentive for thrift in the many small places in the country having now no savings bank facilities which are reached to the post office. It will bring to everyone, however remote from financial centers, a place of perfect safety for deposits with interest return. The pending bill for such banks provides for the investment of the money deposited in national banks in the very places in which it is gathered, or as near thereto as may be practicable. This answers the criticism contained in the Democratic platform, that under the system, the money gathered in the country will be deposited in Wall Street banks. The system of postal savings banks has been tried in so many countries successfully that it cannot be regarded longer as a new and untried experiment. The Democratic platform recommends a tax upon national banks and upon such state banks as may come in the nature of enforced insurance to raise a guarantee fund to pay the depositors of any bank which fails. The proposition is to tax the honest and prudent banker to make up for the dishonesty and imprudence of others. No one can foresee the burden which under this system would be imposed upon the sound and conservative bankers of the country by this obligation to make good the losses caused by the reckless, speculative, and dishonest men who would be enabled to secure deposits under such a system on the face of the proposed insurance. Because, in its present case, the proposal would remove all safeguards against recklessness in banking, and the chief, and in the end probably the only benefit, would accrue to the speculator, who would be delighted to enter the banking business when it was certain that he could enjoy any profit that would accrue, while the risk would have to be assumed by his honest and hardworking fellow. In short, the proposal is wholly impracticable unless it is to be accompanied by a complete revolution in our banking system with a supervision so close as practically to create a government bank. If the proposal were adopted exactly as the Democratic platform suggests, it would bring the whole banking system of the country down in ruin. And this proposal is itself an excellent illustration of the fitness for national control of a party which will commit itself to a scheme of this nature without the slightest sense of responsibility for the practical operation of the law proposed. The Democratic Party announces its adhesion to this plan and only recommends the tried system of postal savings banks as an alternative if the new experimental panacea is not available. The Republican Party prefers the postal savings bank as one tried, safe, and known to be effective, and as reaching many more people now without banking facilities than the new system proposed.
And there you have William Howard Taft speaking on the subject of postal savings banks versus insurance of deposits. And if you are interested, as I say, in hearing more from that campaign, check out the Archaeophone CD, Debate 08, Taft and Bryan Campaign on the Edison Phonograph. Well, from one president, we're going to actually turn to another now. This is somewhat unusual for me to put two talking records next to each other, and let alone two records by United States presidents. But this week marks a very significant anniversary. Some of you may already know what I'm referring to. It was December 7th, 1941, exactly 75 years ago, that the Japanese surprise attack on Pearl Harbor brought the United States into World War II. Franklin D. Roosevelt, on the next day, gave his famous Date in Infamy speech, which is what we'll listen to now, his war address to the Congress of the United States. And this was recorded and released by several different record companies. I have it on Victor, I have it on Columbia, and I have it on this pressing on a tiny little independent label called Diamond Records. This particular 78 was issued in November 1946, apparently in commemoration of the fifth anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Here it is, then, from Washington, D.C. This runs about 7 minutes, spread over two record sides. Here's Franklin D. Roosevelt reminding us of that date, which will live in infamy.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understand the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense. But always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Well, within a week of the attack on Pearl Harbor, songwriters in the United States were already at work on patriotic tunes that reflected this country's involvement in World War II. And we're going to hear one of those now, Dick Robertson and his orchestra, recording on December 16th, 1941. This song had to be written, arranged, and recorded all within 9 days of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Amazing. The tune is by J. Fred Coots, and it's called Goodbye Mama, I'm Off to Yokohama. And it reflects a rather optimistic view of how quickly the war would be won. And it's interesting in hindsight to listen to this bubbly, effervescent sort of tune in connection with going to war. We know now that it was not the knockover that they were expecting. Dick Robertson and the American Four sing the vocal. After that, something from a few months later, January 1942, Harold Grant and his orchestra, which I believe was just a pseudonym for Henry René, and a standard record number T-2051, the Goodfellows, a vocal ensemble, sing In Case of an Air Raid. Now keep in mind, this also is just a little over a month into World War II, and they're still taking a rather, I shouldn't say jolly view of the situation, but an unusually light-hearted view of the situation. The lyrics, if you'll listen to them, say, in case of an air raid, take shelter in my arms. And it's basically just a ploy to get the sweetheart to cuddle a little bit closer. Let's listen to both of these now. First, from just days after the Pearl Harbor attack, here's Dick Robertson and his orchestra. Goodbye, Mama. I'm off to Yokohama.
Johnny was a soldier boy who never looked for scraps, but this young buckaroo was Yankee through and through. Then Johnny heard our country's call to arms against the Japs, and as he marched away, his buddies heard him say, goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama for my red, white, and blue, my country and you. Goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama just to teach all those Japs the Yanks are no saps. A million fighting sons of Uncle Sam, if you please, we'll soon have all those Japs right down on their Japanese. So goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama for my country, my flag, and you.
Goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama for the red, white, and blue, my country and you. Goodbye.
Bye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama just to teach all those Japs. The Yanks are no saps. A million fighting sons of Uncle Sam, if you please. We'll soon have all those Japs right down on their Japanese. So goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama for my country, my flag, and you.
Million fighting sons of Uncle Sam, if you please. We'll soon have all those Japs right down on their Japanese.
So goodbye, Mama. I'm off to Yokohama for my country, my flag, and you.
In case of an air raid, take shelter in my arms. Take shelter in my arms. Obey the rule. Turn off all the lights and turn on your shining charms. Your heart may beat alarm, but please keep cool. If I start kissing you, just do as I do, 'cause I'm your air raid warden and I know what's good for you. In case of an air raid, let's cuddle, you know how. I think it's best to take a test right now. Take shelter in my arms. Take shelter in my arms. Obey the rule. Turn off all the lights and turn on your shining charms. Your heart may beat alarm, but please keep cool. If I start kissing you, just do as I do, 'cause I'm your air raid warden and I know what's good for you. In case of an air raid, let's cuddle, you know how. I think it's best to take a test right now.
Ordinarily, I'm not such a fan of the more patriotic type tunes of that era, if only because I sense that they ordinarily sacrifice musical inventiveness for rather heavy-handed lyrics. And in that case, though, it's rather a clever song. I kind of enjoy it. Melodically, it's quite neat. In case of an air raid, take shelter in my arms. Harold Grant and his orchestra, a pseudonym for Henry René. And I played that for a friend of mine in the area who enjoys sweet bands of the late 30s and early 40s, and he got a real kick out of that. He really, really liked it and tried to claw the record away from me, but I wanted to hang on to that. From January of 1942. Before that, Dick Robertson and his orchestra and... You know, I probably should have cautioned on the lyrics somewhat, a few slurs that we don't ordinarily use anymore. Nevertheless, it was very much of the time. Goodbye, Mama, I'm off to Yokohama, from December of 1941, the tune written by J. Fred Coots. Both of those rather lighthearted, optimistic takes on the United States' new involvement in World War II at the time they were recorded. It's hard to imagine songs like that being composed and performed later on in the war in 1944 or 45 even. My name is Brian Wright. You're listening to the Shellac Stack, a program of 78 RPM records from the first half of the 20th century. We continue now with something from Johnny Marvin. Actually, two things from Johnny Marvin. First, a solo record that he made for Victor on January 6th, 1930. A tune called Have a Little Faith in Me. And we'll follow that with a dance band number. Johnny Marvin joins Nat Shilkret and the Victor Orchestra for a tune called I'd Rather Cry Over You Than Smile at Somebody Else. That was recorded May 3rd, 1928. Both of these are Victor records. Here we go. Have a Little Faith in Me.
I wish I could say in my little way how you set my heart aflame. I tremble with fear whenever you're near. I even forget my name. To live and love you is my only aim. My heart's humming, better times are coming. Have a little faith in me. Skies will clear up just to make you cheer up. Have a little faith in me. In the distance there's a silver lining. I see it shining. And that just means success and happiness. Oh, I'll come through, dear, with the love of you, dear. Have a little faith in me.
I'd rather cry over you than smile at somebody
from vocalist Johnny Marvin. That one's called I'd Rather Cry Over You Than Smile at Somebody Else. Victor 21463. Before that, Johnny Marvin singing solo, Have a Little Faith in Me, recorded January 6th, 1930. That was Victor 22273. Johnny Marvin, a fine singer of the late 20s, whose music I enjoy a lot, and that's why we seem to come back to it so often. We heard some last week when he was under the pseudonym of Honey Duke and His Uke, and here he is under his own name. Well, I believe we have time for one more record on today's stack of shellac here, and we're going to finish off with something from Perry's Hot Dogs, which is essentially a colorful pseudonym for Ben Selvin and his orchestra. This was recorded for the Dime Store Regal label, number 9967. It's called Nobody's Business, and we'll hear one of the studio standbys sing the vocal, a man named Arthur Fields, who recorded just hundreds, probably thousands, of records in the 19-teens and 20s. This one comes to us from December 14th, 1925, 91 years ago. And it's a fun little tune. Here it is, Nobody's Business. Thanks for listening. If you want to send me an email, send it to shellacstack@gmail.com. You know the drill. Or visit the website. But take care until next time, and we'll see you then. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Nobody's business. How she can kiss, believe me, this is nobody's business. We met the preacher yesterday, and this is all I had to say. How I love her and she loves me is nobody's business. Her hair and takes a smoke, nobody's business. She rolls her socks and tells a joke, that's nobody's business. I love this baby, there's no doubt, and she knows what it's all about. But where we go when we step out is nobody's business. Nobody's business.